So I sent George a note last week suggesting we go for a drink or have dinner, and rather than writing back and saying, yeah, sure, he said, well, why not give a seminar while you're here? So clearly being co-director has damaged his brain in some way that we had not previously been aware of. So I agreed to do it. I'm delighted to do it indeed. It's great to be back here. The place has been refurbished considerably since we moved into this space. I expect to see my name in very large Trump-sized letters across the glass here next time I come, as an insult, I guess. So given the time I had, I decided what I would do would be to talk about two projects that I've been involved in over the last couple of years. One of them was an experiment that we carried out on a major survey we were doing in Chicago or in the US, and the other is a method for using historical data to predict what happens to surveys. So it's much more practical, much more practitioner-based topic than the first. And the survey I decided to talk about is this National Social Life and Health and Aging Project, which was originally devised as a study of sexuality in the older population. The older population being, you know, somewhere mid-50s through expiration, approximately. The reason it has this strange title goes back to the political situation in the U.S. in the 90s, which was that at that time the Republican Congress was very agitated about social research and the danger of social research prying into people's lives in any kind of intrusive way, and we were looking for money from the National Institutes of Health. So we couldn't have the word sex anywhere in the title of the project because it would have immediately drawn scrutiny from people who wanted to put a stop to research in general, and especially to any kind of health research that involved a topic of this kind. So I finished up with this name. The reason I wrote it out here is I can never remember what it stands for, NSHAP, but it's the National Social Life and Health and Aging Project. I thought I'd spend 10 minutes maybe talking about the project so you get a sense of what it is. So its purposes were I think kind of interesting in that what it wanted to do is to look at the whole trajectory of what happens to people in older ages. So looking at the whole of their lives and seeing how this plays out over time. So a key element was that it was supposed to be a panel survey. In other words, the same people would be recruited and then followed indefinitely in principle to see what happened to them later on. And one of the difficulties that we have in looking at outcomes, especially health outcomes, is that in general, medical practitioners pay no attention at all to social or psychological characteristics or attributes of their population. So if you look at the medical literature, it always focuses on physical health and biological measures and so on, and there's almost never any context that includes the social context in which people live. And one of my colleagues in Chicago, Ed Lauman, I think is one of the pioneers in social network analysis in sociological research in the US. And his great interest was in how your social network plays into the rest of your life. In other words, how the connections you have are important to all of the outcomes in your existence. I think he started off by looking at networks in terms of academic research and how social networks, academic networks are formed, but it became clear that this was something that you could apply in a wide variety of environments, and it became a matter of some interest. Bob Michael and Ed Lauman did the first study of sexuality in the United States in a study of sexuality among Americans that was published, I guess, in the early 90s. But interestingly enough, the age group they looked at was from 18 to 64. The implication was that after 64, really, I mean, I ask you, why would you include people over 64 in a study of sexuality? So as Lauman aged, apparently he felt that this constraint on age was perhaps unnecessarily low. So the investigators felt it would be interesting to see what happened after that point. In other words, what happened to people beyond that stage in terms of sexual attitudes and sexual behavior, but linking it to social attitudes, social networks, physical and mental health. So the idea was to collect all of this information and then plot what happens to people over time. The idea was to re-interview people every 3 years. Eventually it became every 5 years, to see to what extent what you measured in the first instance projected into what happened in later stages of their lives. The model is this. I wasn't involved in developing this model. I think it's really ugly. but it has the benefit of having lots of words in it, and a new word, I think, which is the, what is it, biopsychosocial. This is a biopsychosocial model of, it's sort of missing the word economic. You know, you think biosocial, psycho-econo, you know, model of biology, of models. But the idea here is that all of these things feed into each other. I mean, you always worry about a model where all of the arrows point at everything else. But I mean, this just suggests you got to be very smart to do this. I think that's really what this is supposed to imply. So we're very smart. So what do we do? About 15 years ago, we started designing the survey. The first wave was carried out in 2005, 2006. And this was a sample of adults between 57 and 85. 3,000 adults between 57 and 85. And the response rate was 75.5%, which is really quite high. This is a face-to-face survey of people aged between 57 and 85. Then 5 years later, in 2010, we went back to all of the people whom we had interviewed in the first wave, and also to the people that who didn't respond to the first wave. So we went back to the non-respondents from wave one, and also included their co-resident domestic or romantic partners. And that's one. The first thing I'm going to talk about is how we tested whether this was a good idea or not. And here the response rate was really quite high, about 90% re-interview rate. And the overall response rate, that's the unconditional rate, that's taking the whole sample to begin with, the percentage of those we had as respondents in the second wave was only dropped by 1.5% from the first wave, because we converted a fairly large number of non-respondents from wave one during wave two. So our unconditional response rate was 74%. And this year, last year and this year, we're still doing this. We go back to all of the surviving respondents from the two waves. These people are dying off now. This is an older population. They're now aged between, 67 and 95. And we also got money from the National Institute on Aging, National Institute of Health, to add a new cohort. In other words, the next birth cohort for us, which is people born between, 1947 and 1960-something. I can't remember. 65, maybe. So that's what's in the field at the moment. And the response rates have continued to be high. We're almost finished with the field work for this year's repeat, and the response rate for the new cohort is, again, over 75%. And for those of you who don't know face-to-face surveys and what's happening to the response rates, this is really a very high response rate, and it's particularly high because this involves spending 2 hours in the home. So this is not a short interview. The interviewer spends 2 hours in the home, including collecting a whole bunch of biomeasures, so blood, saliva, various other biomeasures I'll talk about in a moment. Given that the investigators still don't think there's enough information, we leave people a 25, 30-minute leave-behind questionnaire for them to fill in afterwards and send back in. And for a sample of them, we give them the equivalent of a Fitbit, an accelerometer, a wristband, whatever, that will measure all their activity, usually over a period of 3 days. So we actually plot their physical activity for a period of time as well. So a quick look at the measures we have. These are the social measures that are included. I won't go through them in detail, but the point about it is that they ask people about all of their intimate connections, intimate now being people with whom they have some communication beyond some frequency. So it would ask you who are the five people with whom you're most commonly in contact, and then ask a whole bunch of information about these people, and also ask about the demands that these people make on you as well as the demands you make on those people. This is the base question, which is, looking back over the last 12 months, who are the people with whom you most often discuss things that were important to you? So this is a fairly vague question, but it's well established in the social network literature as being a reasonable question to generate people's real network. So it's not who are the people you have to talk to. This is who are the people that you most often speak to that in some way are important in your life. We go up to five people, the first five. If they don't happen to mention, for example, their partner in the list, they're asked specifically about their partner, who's then added if they have a partner. Sometimes people don't add their partner because they don't talk to their partner. Other times they don't add their partner because they kind of assume that's the case, so they just think of other people besides their partner in terms of coming up with the list. Between waves, we have to reconcile these networks. It's possible that in the original interview, somebody was put down as Tim, And then the second interview is done as Timothy or James or Jim. So the interviewer is instructed. All interviewer instructions are typically in capital letters to distinguish them from the rest of the questionnaire, to check that if names are the same, whether they're the same people, or if the name and if names are different, if they might be the same people. It might be a new partner, it might be another child, or whatever. So we ask about relationship quality. And I want you to think about how you would respond to these questions. I mean, these are not trivial questions, and they're intrusive in terms of asking people a lot of questions about the people they're related to, how they relate to them, whether they're satisfied with it or not, whether they think their partners are satisfied with them. And this applies across a whole range of activities, including, and we had some concern about this as a sensitivity issue, sexual activity, sexual problems, sexual attitudes, because these are not typically included in social surveys. Now, we know the hardest thing to get information on is economics, is finance. We did not include finance in this survey. There's another major survey in the US, the Health and Retirement Survey, that asks an enormous amount of information about finance, so we didn't include it at all in this survey. Mental health, we ask people about their mental health. We give them a number of questionnaires that measure psychological condition, including their personality. Some of my colleagues work a lot on these measures. I have done it myself.
An incentive, Colin.
Pardon?
An incentive.
We give them $100 to participate, and we tell them the $20 is for doing the Leave Behind questionnaire. We give them the whole $100 when they do the interview. Not cheap, but still, you know, it's a couple of hours at least, maybe 2.5 hours by the time the interviewer gets in, gets settled down, sets up, and so on. You also get a cognitive function measure. I always find these things vaguely terrifying. Ever since I was a child, I've suffered from test anxiety. I think my parents were too ambitious for me. Let that be a warning to you. It doesn't work out well. So whenever I see these things, I kind of feel I'm going to fail it. Like, can you guys do this? You're supposed to follow this sequence here. See this part here? You're supposed to be able to work out where to go next. And be brave enough to say what it is. Anyway, so this is and the usual. This is a standard test. Some of you may be familiar with it. The MoCA. I forgot to ask what the hell the rhinoceros is doing here. Obviously, his elephant never forgets. The rhinoceros said, I don't. I think you're supposed to recognize the rhinoceros. What do you think? Yeah? But surely that depends on your upbringing a bit. Not a common sight in some neighborhoods. Physical health, we ask them a lot about their health, how they feel. We ask them about any diagnoses they've had, and we take a medication log. In other words, the interviewer goes through all of the medicines that they take with them, or goes through their medicine cabinet and goes through all the medication and writes down what they take and the dosages. And then finally, we do a whole bunch of biometrics. This was considered quite radical when we first started doing this a dozen years ago. Interviewers did not typically do this, so we didn't want to use medical professionals to do this data collection. So the question was, what could just regular trained survey interviewers do in terms of collecting these kinds of things from people? And the ones that we included are given here. Most of them are pretty straightforward. You know, height, weight, waist measurement. Blood pressure, again, there's some dispute as to whether non-professionals could take blood pressure reasonably well. It turns out not to be terribly complicated to do this. Chair stand, sensory. One of the quite interesting results we've had recently is smell. Some of our colleagues in the medical school have discovered that poor olfactory sense, the poor sense of smell, is a very good predictor of death. Well, that's another thing to worry about. My contention is that it's the trajectory that's a predictor. So we had measured a smell measure in wave two. We've done it again in wave three. But my guess is that, as in most things, it's not the absolute level. It's a question of whether you have a deterioration that predicts whether something's going to happen to you or not. But we don't have the data yet to discover that. Accelerometry, this is wearing whatever they call these things, I mean, something like a Fitbit. We tested for HIV. One of the most controversial things with vaginal swabs, which are carried out only on women, of course, for obvious reasons, in waves one and two, these are self-administered. And so we were very worried about the response rate. First of all, we were worried that people would just be offended and, you know, break off the interview. And then we thought the response rate would be very, very low. So what would you predict the response rate was for Erasmus Watt? This is a generation born between 1920 and 1947. So it's quite an old generation. What would your prediction be?
90%.
Thank you, Pat, for at least give us a number.
I just wanted to pick it out.
67%. So two-thirds. Which is higher, I think, than I would have anticipated. But the most important thing was that people were not offended by this and didn't find that it didn't seem to damage the relationship with the interviewer. Almost all our interviewers were women, although not all. This was also a concern. And in all cases where we were interviewing women, we offered the respondent a female interviewer rather than a male interviewer. For males, we weren't particularly concerned with women. And then the Leave Behind questionnaire, which is another half an hour of work. This involved partly questions that researchers hadn't been able to get into the main interview. Now, there's always, if you've ever worked in a team, you'll find that everybody wants to put their own stuff in. There's far too much stuff to do. But then also some questions about your sexual relationship and some sexual behaviors that we were concerned might be difficult for the respondent to answer directly in a face-to-face interview. And the response rate for the Leave Behind questionnaire was a conditional 84%. So 84% of those who did the interview subsequently sent back the Leave Behind questionnaire.
Were they interviewed one-to-one?
Pardon?
Would they be interviewed as couples?
Yeah, no, only one. We select only one person in the household. So this was a very important decision that we made at the beginning, that we would take only one person in the household, partly for reasons of contamination and partly for reasons of response bias. So we were concerned that if we ask you and we ask your partner, and you know we're going to ask your partner, you might think, well, I'm not so sure about that now. Right? It's a little tricky. And then the interviewer collected a lot of information at the same time. And this comes exactly to your question. So having interviewed only one person per household in the first wave, and this was partly because I thought that it would be too risky to interview two, and in general there was a concern that interviewing more than one person in the household would be difficult. When it came to wave two, we were concerned for two reasons. One is we thought we might have been wrong, and that's always a possibility. And the positive was we had a 75% response rate, which suggested that the survey was more successful and less intimidating than we had feared. And secondly, people were dying off. You know, we had 3,000 people aged 55 to 84, 57 to 85. But you know, as 5 years go by, a fair number, especially the older group, starts to die out. So the sample was clearly going to attrit very substantially through mortality over time. And we thought it would be useful to increase the sample size as well without having to go back to a whole fresh set of households. So we wanted to see whether we could interview the partners or not. There's a real problem whenever you try to do something like this. So we've done the first wave with one person per household, right? Carefully and deliberately done this. And that had been successful. Now, if we're going to start interviewing partners in wave two, and if in fact it had a bad effect on the data, then we never know, right? I mean, there's no way to tell whether you've affected the data in wave two if you interview partners in wave two, right? Because you just get data. So you don't know whether the data you're getting are the result of interviewing your partner as well, or whether they would have been like that in any case. So we had a big fight in the investigator team about whether we should do this or not, and if so, how. So we decided we should do it, but I argued, and I'm sure most of you would argue, being in the Methodology Institute, that you really need to test it. So you can't just do this and then hope for the best. You should test it. The problem with testing things in real life is that it means you have to have a control group, and a control group means you don't get information for the control group. And if there's anything that annoys people more than being told what to do, it's being told they have to give up cases in order to do something they don't want to do. So we had a sustained battle about whether or not to have a true experiment where we tested this with a control group, and the right side was victorious, as you would always hope. And we decided we would have a control group. So that's what we did. So this is just a quick summary of why we did and why we didn't. What the other reason for not having more than one person in the household is, if you take more than one in a household, they tend to be homogeneous, right? You get increased homogeneity within a household, so for the same sample size, you'd have lower precision. The design effect would be larger, so for the same sample size, you'll have lower precision. And that's why all of survey literature is full of methods for selecting one person per household, on the phone, on the web, mail questionnaires, and face-to-face interview. There's a problem about contamination, and then a problem about potential non-response. On the other hand, it was clear from the data that when you want to analyze people's social networks, and especially their intimate social network, which would be their partners and the closest relationship they have, that having only one side of the partnership report is clearly a serious flaw in terms of the substantive content of what you've got. So it would be much better to have information from both partners about the relationship. It's not that you want them to agree. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable that you could have a partnership where one person says everything is great and the other person says everything is terrible. I mean, that doesn't mean that either of them is lying, right? The relationship is not necessarily symmetrical in terms of what happens. And somebody who thinks their relationship is great, or two people who think their relationship is great, one of whose partners agrees and one of whose partners does not agree, are really quite different social situations for the individual to be in. So having this additional data from the partners was clearly of great value in terms of the analysis of the data that we had. There's also something to be said for analyzing couples as a pair, in other words, analyzing the partnership as an entity, rather than analyzing the individuals within the partnership. So there were strong reasons for including the partner in the analysis, and that's why we decided to do it. So the first question, these are a list of questions. They're really very boring. The question is really, does it affect the response rate for the primes? The primes are the people we already had in the survey. Or does it affect their responses? So who do they start? Does it introduce response bias into their responses? And for the partners, does it affect their response rate? And can we tell anything about whether it influences their data or not? And this is just a long list of these questions. One of the things that I was interested in specifically was this difference here, which is when you tell the respondent that you're going to do this, that you're going to include their partner. One way to do it is to say up front, Ben, I'm going to, before I start, I say, but I'd just like you to know that I'd like to interview your partner as well, ask the same questions, whatever. And the other way is just get through your interview and at the very end and say, oh, by the way, Ben, you have a partner, we'd like to ask your partner about this at the end, right? A lot of people wanted to go with this because they thought this would reduce the impact on the responses, right, that you don't know, and therefore this would reduce the impact. Other people felt this would be better because it seems more ethical or more straightforward to do this. I felt this was better anyway because we have some evidence in the survey literature that giving an interviewer an unpleasant task as something in the future damages their whole behavior. You know, it used to be that with difficult questions, when we found out that people would reject or refuse to answer difficult questions, oh, well, let's put them all at the end, because then they won't do any harm. But it turns out that the interviewer knows they're at the end, and therefore the whole of the interview is contaminated by the fact the interviewer is thinking, this part is okay, but wait, we get to the last section where I have to ask you, think of, social relationships you have where you have bad news to impart, and what it does to the rest of your communication on the occasion, right? I mean, it really doesn't improve the part that should not be affected. So there seemed to be some advantage to putting it up front and seeing what happened in that case. And then we had a group whom we did not, where there was no mention of their partner, and we had no intention of recruiting their partner. This is the principal group. These are people who did have a partner in wave one. Some respondents acquired a partner in between wave one and wave two. I'm not going to talk so much about them. This is the group we're primarily interested in here. 20% of them were in the control group, 50% in the tell before, because I thought it was a better method, and 30% in the tell after. But for analytic purposes, that's a minor detail. Okay. This is a diagram. Same thing. This is what we told them. You can read it for yourself, or not. If you don't want to read it, just take a short break while you don't read it. So the interviewer gave this verbatim to all of the respondents. You notice we didn't ask them whether we could approach their partner. This was, do you have any questions before we do it? So we were stating that we were going to do it anyway, and we didn't say, but of course, there are circumstances where you didn't do it because it became clear that it was not going to be acceptable. But very few. So here are the two groups. The primes are the people who are in wave one. The partners are the cohabiting spouses, or romantic partners who are identified as part of the social network roster that we had. Okay. So these are the people who had no partner in wave one. A couple of them did generate new partners. And you see there's a slightly higher response rate for the people in the tell before than the tell after. This is actually statistically significant, but it doesn't make any sense to me because they don't have partners, nearly all of them, right? So I don't know what the hell is going on here. But
why were they assigned to conditions then?
Because they might have required a partner.
No, so
if they're part of partner,
up, right.
If they're part of partner, then they were assigned to one or other of the two conditions. Okay. But there were only generated 43 partners out of all of these. I mean, these are relatively older people, so not many of them are acquiring, who didn't have partners, have acquired a new partner. And it's kind of odd that we get this difference, given that there's so few who are affected by this whole activity. Right? It just seems strange. Maybe this outburst of honesty for these people thought, oh, this is a respectable crew. They're warning me in advance about stuff, even though it's not relevant, so it increases my faith in them. I don't know. I have no explanation for it. This is what happened for those who had a partner. And I have rarely seen a set of numbers that are... I did not carry out a statistical test on these numbers, but I'm quietly confident that it's not significant under any sustainable model. Okay, so the response rates were the same. I mean, that's really good news, and not necessarily expected. I mean, that's really not something that we had anticipated. We hoped for, but certainly didn't anticipate it. We looked at the demographic distribution. This should be the same, and these are randomized. We didn't control for these in the randomization, but it was a randomized experiment, so they shouldn't be different. We looked at their interview variables, especially the ones we thought might be sensitive questions. There were a couple that had significant differences. So I almost apologize for putting them up, because we did enough comparisons that you expect at least some to be significant by chance. But the two that were for women, whether they reported feeling pain during sex slightly higher for the tell before than tell after. Our underlying hypothesis here is you're more likely to understate this than overstate it. You know, it's a somewhat difficult thing to report, and therefore this would be more likely to be correct than this. So to the extent that we have a prior hypothesis about it. And the other was whether sex was not pleasurable for men. There was also a slight difference between these two groups, and the control group was a little higher. But that's all there was. So, I mean, really, I put them up only because we did find them, but not because I think they're particularly interesting. Here are the case for partner response rates. These were the partners that were generated among those who didn't have a partner. As I said, there were very few of them. This is not an important difference. And here you see that the people whose partners were told before the interview that they were going to be selected had slightly better response rate than the people who were told after. This is not a statistically significant difference. No, it's maybe a little one standard error or something, 1.5 standard errors, but it's in the same direction as the rest of the results. So in that sense, I think it has, you know, it's mildly interesting. So the good news for us overall was that there was no difference in the overall response rate for the prime. So it did not seem to affect the response rate in wave two. And that was really important in terms of its impact on the panel and the analysis of the panel. Responses also had no sign of bias. Remember, the control group would not be affected by this change because their partner was never mentioned as a possible interviewee in the control group. And the responses were pretty much systematically identical across the three groups. And for the partners, there was a slight finding of higher response rate among those whose original respondents had been told before the interview that they were going to be interviewed. But you know, I don't think it's really terribly important. We also looked to be on the safe side at the trajectory between wave one and wave two. In other words, was it affecting the analysis of the changes from one way to the other? Almost necessarily it wasn't, given what we had in the first set of results, but it wasn't anyway. And we still have to look at the leave-behind questionnaire. But my guess is that there's nothing there, which is why I haven't gotten around to it yet. So even though these were a very strong null set of results, they're quite important to us and quite unexpected in among the social science who work in this kind of data collection. Now, there are a couple of things you want to bear in mind. We had already interviewed the primes, right? So we already had a relationship with them. We'd interviewed them for a couple of hours 5 years before. So it's not like they're turning up on the doorstep for the first time to do this, right? That's and they had a fair amount of confidence in the operation, and that they felt it didn't divulge information from wave one. You know, so this is more positive than an average survey would be. But other than that, it's about as sensitive a set of topics as you could imagine, and the fact that people were apparently not affected by the notion that their partners were going to be interviewed on the same topic quite soon afterwards didn't have any effect on the results. So as a result, we're doing partners again in wave three, of course, when we've almost finished, and we decided for the new cohort to recruit partners right from the beginning. Now, slightly risky. This is not identical to recruiting partners in the second wave of the study, but the results were so strong. In other words, there was such clear evidence of no effect that we decided that we would include the partners at this stage. Any question about that before? Yes?
Yeah, when conducting the interviews, did you ask the partner to leave the room, I guess?
The interviews were almost always conducted with the person on their own. So the protocol for the interview was that the person would be asked to be interviewed on their own.
Okay.
So there were very few cases where the partner wished to be, was present during the interview.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking that if it's private homes, you know,
yep.
Sound can travel easily in private homes.
Oh, true, just like email, right?
Yeah.
You have to be careful what you say. Yeah, well, but remember that the control group gives us protection against this, except that, you know, potentially the control group could also be overheard, but the good news is older people's hearing goes up as well.
Was the partner interview the same length, another 2 hours?
Identical.
Okay.
So identical.
4 to 5 hours total.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was rare for the interviewer to do both in the household on the same day.
Okay.
And usually it took another call to get the partner to agree, although not always. So there were some cases where the partner was enthusiastic about being interviewed. You know, if you live a fairly quiet life and you're retired or whatever, and somebody comes and asks you all these unexpected questions about your medical history, your physical, biological health, takes blood samples and all this stuff, and also asks you all these detailed questions about your sexual behavior and attitude, you kind of remember it. No, it's not like your average day at home. And it was clear that some respondents had then told their partner, you know, like when the interview got, you'd be amazed, you won't do. So some partners were actually embracing this notion of being interviewed because they felt they also wanted to spend 2 hours talking about their lives and their sexuality, and it wasn't right that they should be excluded. But it did not seem to... I tried very hard to get interesting results because it's usually better to have signs of response bias or whatever, but we couldn't find any.
That's what I was going to sort of, make that point, is that you've got a sample, you've sort of said this a bit already, but you've got an engaged sample, you've already interviewed them, and they're also this demographic, they vote more, they respond to surveys more, and you're giving them $100. So I think there's questions about, I guess, whether it's a general...
Yeah, you're right, that's absolutely right. But on the other hand, it's a much tougher survey than most.
Yeah.
You
said, methodology, do the experiment, figure out. What was the rationale for $100? That's,
that was from the beginning. So we did in the early, we piloted this stuff in the early 2000s, before we went to the field for the first time. And of course, we have a lot of experience with incentives, which are usually much less than $100. But our concern was having 2 to 2.5 hours. In the home was a sufficient imposition that it needed more than that. And we decided arbitrarily on $100. I mean, this was like a Steve Smith, who ran the fieldwork in the first wave, who was here at OPCS and originally is now over at NORC, and I really decided $100 seemed about right. Now, $100 sounds a lot more than 80, for example. No, $100 seems like, you know, it even sounds a lot more than 90.
There was the American Statistical Association released a statement yesterday or the day before.
Someone
had, I don't know who the person was, but some sort of right-wing commentator.
David Lazarus, in the LA Times.
That's right, had made some kind of critical comments about the, you know, the government giving people money
Actually quite an interesting point that Pat raises. There was an article in the LA Times, Los Angeles Times, a couple of days ago by journalist David Lazarus, who was kind of mocking an incentive experiment that was carried out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics on the current expenditure survey, which is, you know, what the CPI is built on, which is a long, incredibly boring survey. How many pairs of socks did you buy? What kind of socks were they? How many shirts did you buy over a 3-month period? You know, it's a five measure for 1 month, 1 year survey. And they'd been testing the use of incentives, and they were testing a $5 incentive for people to take part in this survey. And this journalist got hold of this and sort of wrote, what you kind of expect is now the government is giving money to people to do surveys or whatever. And Roger Sharangio, who's the president of APOR now, and I've forgotten who the president of the American Statistics Association, wrote a letter to the LA Times saying, you know, this is a serious business. We've spent decades testing incentives, and incentives work, and they save money because in the long run, it's much cheaper to give someone $5 now than to have to make 10 extra calls in order to get an interview. There's deep suspicion about...
The Welsh government do a survey that I've got something called, the National Survey for Wales, and that's one of a number of surveys that refuse to do unconditional incentives. Even though the evidence suggests that unconditional is more effective, they won't do it because the perception of the government sending out money to people for doing nothing. They'll do a conditional one, but only if they can demonstrate with experiments that it actually is cost neutral.
You're perfectly right. All the evidence for, especially for mail surveys, for postal surveys, or internet surveys, is an unconditional incentive is the only one that works. That's when you send people the money up front, whether they do the survey or not. Now, in face-to-face surveys, the evidence is not like that. So for face-to-face surveys, because you're already there, I mean, so there, almost all incentives are conditional on doing the survey. But it's a transaction at the time. I mean, you're in the house and you're saying, you know, we can give you $100 if you do the interview, and it's all happening at the same time. So in that case, we don't do prepaid incentives for face-to-face surveys. But this is the National Institute of Health, which is not quite the government. I mean, it's like the, what's the corresponding medical research?
MRC?
MRC, yeah, and the MRC here. But you have to be careful about
dollars.
Other than that, it's the same principle. Okay, so the second topic I wanted to cover is, I used to call this projecting response rate, but that was not getting any traction. So I changed the title to predictive analysis for fieldwork performance, which I hope you recognize is much more impressive. Right? Contains a number of important words. Predictive analysis together is now something that carries enormous weight. Most people.
Analytics, which was
We're going to upstream the product eventually. You'd be glad to hear. Performance is another good word, so I changed it to predictive analytics for people performance, but it is actually about projecting response rates. But this is an example of predictive analytics. So what are predictive analytics? Well, predictive analytics means you get some data and you make a prediction, right? That's really basically all it amounts to. What's interesting is we have a lot of data that we don't use. And this comes from a collaboration that I had with a bunch of people over the last 10 years, really, at NORC. NORC is the National Opinion Research Center, which is a survey organization associated with the University of Chicago, one of the biggest second biggest survey organization in the U.S. Interesting. if you can read the top line, that's not critical, I guess. So one of the biggest problems in survey fieldwork is trying to tell what's going to happen in time. Right? So this is a typical actual response rate in the field over, in this case, 6 weeks of a survey. This is actually for the first 6 weeks of wave one of NCHA. And at this point, you really have no idea whether you're doing well or doing badly, right? So the problem is you don't know whether the response rate is going to follow that trajectory or whether it's already peaked. And the question is there anything we can do that will narrow this funnel of potential outcomes for the survey? That's based on data, as distinct from just based on we think something's going to happen. Now, good field organizations usually do have a good sense of what's happening. So the people who work in the field, that's the operations people, have a good idea, but they have no protocol for doing this, and it depends how good they are. I mean, and they can't replicate it. You know, so one person may say, I've done this survey before, this is what's going to happen, but somebody else won't be able to get the same information from the same data. So the sorts of things we'd like to be able to know are, do we have to change anything, and ideally change it soon rather than later? In other words, if things are going badly, the sooner we know, the better. If you're doing a contract, and one of the examples I'm going to give is, in fact, a big federal contract, these contracts will often have clauses about minimum response rates or notification to the client that things are going badly. So when should you tell someone that things are going badly? And you have to know they're going badly to tell them they're going badly. And the third is perhaps in some ways the most significant organizationally is, can we produce an inferential tool or an analytics tool that people can use without understanding it? In other words, we can give it to any survey and they can run it and it will give them the information and they don't have to have me or somebody else on the statistics team to tell them how to interpret the data that we get. So can we get a plug-in that will just do this for people as the field work unfolds, no matter what the survey is? So I first gave this talk at NORC and I made the point of explaining how many people have been involved in it and how important it was to have these folks. These are the people who actually run the surveys. These are the senior professional staff together with some statisticians and methodologists who work with them to make this happen. But you can't do it on your own. So this I started doing many years ago. We were doing a whole set of surveys for the Annie Casey Foundation in inner city areas across the U.S. And we had never done these kinds of surveys before, so we wanted to figure out were we doing well or not. And about halfway through the fieldwork in the first city, which was Denver, we called all of the field supervisors and asked them to look at all the cases they were working and give a prediction of whether these cases would be completed or not. Right? So look at all the cases where you have an appointment, what proportion of these will generate an interview? Look at all the cases where you have never talked to anybody yet, what proportion of these will generate an interview? So for every subset of cases, what was the interviewer's or the supervisor's prediction of how many of them would work out? And then we put that into a model to predict what the final outcome would be, and then tracked it over time. Now, it turned out that the predictions were all wrong, right? But they were rank ordered correctly, right? So the rank order that they predicted of the appointments, maybe 70% would complete. Of the non-contacts, maybe 40% would complete, and of the refusals, maybe 10%. And the numbers were actually 90, 70, and 30, for example. Right? So they had the rank order and approximately the ratios right, but the numbers were all wrong because, of course, you know, field supervisors don't want to predict high outcome because then they get blamed if it doesn't happen. Right? But at least we started with the numbers from the people working directly in the field. So I used a simple scaler to correct their predictions for the actual in one city and then tried it in the second city, which was Seattle. And in Seattle it did really quite well. And we worked on this model over a period of time, and by the time we were finished, our model was predicting within 2 or 3% of the final response rate within 5 weeks of the start of the survey. These were 12-week field periods for the surveys. And this was despite the fact that one was a Latino community in San Antonio compared to an Asian community in Seattle compared to an African-American community in Indianapolis. Right? So it wasn't that they were exactly the same, but the pattern of response prediction seemed to work reasonably well in those. And finally, when we came to NSHAP Wave 1, I decided to develop the models further in this case. Let me tell you essentially what we're doing. This is what there's a record of calls for every case in the survey, and after every interview, the interviewer writes down one of these pieces of information for what's happened, either a virgin case, a case that has not yet have been touched, right? So nobody's gone to that case yet. No contact is when just don't, nobody answers. This means nobody home or whatever. A contact, which could be either refusal or non-refusal or an appointment. Some other non-response, an appointment, a complete out of scope means they don't belong in the survey population. And then for each individual case, we have a sequence of call attempts. And these are the outcomes for this particular case, 154. This was the sequence of calls. No contact, a refusal, no contact, no contact, an appointment, refusal, refusal, no contact. You notice refusals are not taken as absolute in this business, right? Refusals are could be anything from I'm too busy, which some interviewers will interpret as a soft appointment, you know, to I am going to take my gun out the next time, which might be classified as a hard refusal, and maybe, but otherwise, soft refusals are considered to be still in play until the end of the survey. Now, these are a lot of different classifications for this case, and if you try to build a very complex model, then, you know, it would get out of control very quickly, because you'd have, for each individual case, you'd have all of these different sequences. And each sequence would have its own characteristics, so a very complex model would mean that you have a very small base for making predictions with that model. So what we decided to do was to simplify this according to something. This is a slightly simpler version of what we have. Each disposition would be either a no contact, a refusal, an appointment, a complete or an out of scope. Right? These are the five primary categorizations. And we observed empirically that given the most recent disposition, whether you had had a refusal in the past or not was critical to what the outcome was going to be. Right? So if you'd ever refused, your chances of completion were lower than if you had never refused. So we built a matrix, which is essentially for every week in the survey, and you do this on the basis of your data, of all of the cases in week two that had never had a refusal. 60% of them, empirically, looking at the end of the survey, 60% of them did complete. Of those that had a refusal in their history here, 0.6, 0.59, if they had only one, here, none. If you had an appointment in week two, you're almost certain to complete the survey. If you were complete, you would always complete the survey. I mean, complete means you're done. So you'll notice that these change over time. So each category, which is the highest disposition, so if George is not home the first time, and the second time he makes an appointment, but the third time he refuses, then his highest disposition is an appointment, right? He made an appointment, but he has had a refusal, so he'd be in this category here. And as you see, as the survey goes on, somebody with that disposition gets less and less likely to complete. If you're in that situation early on, we're almost certainly going to convert you. If you're in that situation in week 22, we only have a 1 in 3 chance of converting you. And if you're in that situation towards the end, we're very unlikely. So these probabilities get lower as time goes on. The closer we are to the end, the less likely we are to convert any particular case. So we have a matrix of probabilities for each disposition for each week of the survey. And we build a transition matrix. Well, this is just a simple matrix that you multiply by the number of cases in each category, and that gives you a prediction of the response rate week by week as you go through the survey. So just to show you what happened with NCHOP Wave 1, remember the first part, the first 6 weeks was kind of around here. This is what actually happened. Okay, so it's pretty good. We got 3,000 cases at the end. And the question is, how can we get from down here to knowing where we're going to finish up here? This is the model that we developed for Wave 1. This was based on earlier. The blue line is the projection, and the red line is the actual. So by week six, we had completed 480 interviews, and we were projecting that we would have 2,800 interviews by the end of the survey. Right? Remember, this is the first time we had done it on this. At this point, it looks as if we were a little high here. Here in week 20 or so, they had converged. Then things started to happen. You notice this is not perfect modeling, right? This is not too bad here, but you see something happened here. That suggests our model wasn't working very well, right? And in fact, we know what happened here because we were doing the survey. I mean, post hoc, we knew what was happening. So at the crucial points in this operation, we got rid of our ineffective interviewers at this point as the first vertical line, and at this point we switched from a $100 incentive to a $400 incentive. So this probably would have been the real rate that we would have gotten to if we hadn't had all the money to get that last piece of the analysis here. But the thing to remember is these projections were built on surveys that had nothing to do with sexuality and nothing to do with this age group. So these were built on the General Social Survey, which is a social, like the British Social Attitude Survey, and other surveys that were not at all like this survey. And nevertheless, they did a reasonably good job of telling us approximately where we would finish early on in the survey. So what we've done since, we also modified the model here. See model 7. Nobody knows what happened to models 2, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 10. Model 7 was our new model, post hoc. So we did the same thing for wave 3, which is the wave that's just finished or finishing. And we looked at three different groups. First, we looked at the returning respondents, predicting the response rate for the returning respondents. Second, we had a screener for wave 3. A screener, we don't know who's in the age group, for 50 to 66-year-olds. You have to go to the household, do a roster of the household, identify whether there's anybody there. So that's stage one. And then subsequently, there's an interview stage. So there were three things we were trying to predict: returning respondents response rate, screener response rate, and interview response rate for the new cohort. This is what happened with the returning respondents. You'll see that by week 10 or so, week 11 perhaps, the projected response rate had stabilized almost completely, right? And that here we have an almost completely stable response rate, despite the fact that, of course, the actuals are nowhere near it. And in fact, I didn't bring it with me because I didn't have time to download the data and run it. But the actual response rate has finished up just about here. So this response rate projection has remained stable from week 11 through to week, and we are now in week 42 or something. And it's now converging on the response rate that we projected in week 11. This is like really good. We're very pleased with that. And it suggests that for a repeat survey like this, where we're building the model on previous behavior of the same people, which is essentially what we're doing here, this model works very well. This is what happened with the screeners. This is the new cohort, screening households, to find out if there's an eligible respondent in the households. This is an example of a model that's simply not working, right? How would you characterize the failure of the model here? This is the model projection here, and this is the actual here. So what's the model doing systematically in this case? Ignore the first part is always hopeless, because there are very few cases in the field the first few weeks.
It's keeping up with the facts.
Yeah, it's clearly not, the data are outperforming the model, right? So the response rate is the probabilities are higher than the model is saying at all stages along the process here. And in fact, this continued. We finally did finish at 92.5% out here, but the model continued to rise almost. So these gradually converged, but the model never hit the final number until we got there. So here, clearly, screeners do not behave in the same way as the two R interview, right? So getting a screener done does not have the same probabilities as getting a major interview done, and in fact the probabilities are higher. That's kind of what you'd expect. But clearly we didn't know how much of it you'd expect, so for the next wave we'll have to recalibrate this model to see if it'll work. And then finally, this is for the new cohort. And again, so once we had done the screener, what proportion would respond? And here again you see that here a little earlier by week 7 or 8, the response rate had projection had converged to about 75%, and the final response rate is going to be 75.3%. So this really is very tight, very, very strong prediction in this case. So just the last couple of months, we've tried to apply this to another survey. And this survey is called the Survey of Consumer Finances. It's done for the Federal Reserve, the US Federal Reserve, who print the money. I don't know if they print money anymore, but whatever the electronic equivalent of printing money is. And this involves a screener again, followed by a screener, followed by an interview. And it's a cross-sectional survey, so it's unlike in CHOP, it's not the same people in different occasions, but we do have records from previous waves. So we have previous versions of this survey, especially one that was in the field for 3 years ago, in 2013. So what we did was we built the model originally on the EdChop data, But then when we found that we could actually get data from 2013, the field records of 2013, we built a model based entirely on 2013, on the outcomes of 2013. We fitted that model in 2013, it fitted very well. I mean, if you build a model on the data, it should fit the data very well. And now we're running it on 2016. So this is the model that we built. This is from the previous round. I don't know if you can see at the top. So these are not surprising. The only thing that's surprising is that they're not perfect. But now we look at this model applied to new data. And this survey just started a couple of months ago. I don't remember now. Maybe we see in a minute what week we're in. We're in 26, because we were 6 months into the survey. So this is the screener response rate. Now remember, this screener model was built on a previous screener. It wasn't built on a previous interview. So it's built on another short, at the doorstep interview to find out the composition of the household. And this is really quite remarkable. Now these are data, so this is a prediction based on what happened 3 years ago to a similar population, but not the same sample. Like, these are all different people. And this seems to be a remarkably stable projection from, I mean, this is really week two or week three, right? So yes,
the first point, there's no data there. So is that first point in the projection simply what happened 3 years prior?
We put in a starting value for untouched cases, and that's what that is.
Okay, I'm just curious, you know, is this working because the screener response rates are identical to what they were 3 years prior, or is it actually finding a different level?
It's a different level. Where are we? It's a different level, and all of these numbers are based only on probabilities and not on. So these are conversion probabilities, right? So, of course, if the configuration were the same year on year from 2013 to 2016, and the pattern of the configuration stayed the same, then you would get the same thing.
Yeah.
But when you go from this point to this point here, or from this point to this point, it depends on the dispositions, but also how many there are in every cell. Mm-hmm. So the only case in which it would be driven completely by 3 years ago is if everything remained the same. Like the same number of appointments were made, the same number of them were converted, and that's pretty unlikely as far as we can tell, right? So this level
is, you know, in distribution, it might look sort of similar, yeah, doing the same exercise three years later. Yeah. I guess it's more impressive if you immediately find a different a level that proves to be, you know, quite different from the previous time.
It is different, but not, but and it could be different. It's still very stable, right?
Yeah.
And a big concern here tends to be a secular change for people becoming more resistant to surveys, right? So this should pick that up immediately, because it should say, we're not getting the conversion rates we got 3 years ago for the same field dispositions.
Yeah.
And that does not appear to be the case. Here are the number of screener completes. This varies from, this is not as stable, because that depends more on out-of-scope cases, which stabilize only after a while. You don't know that a bunch of households are out-of-scope until later in the process. This is the questionnaire response rate. This is actually, to answer your previous question, this is considerably higher than it was in 2013, like by 2 percentage points. That's considerably higher for, once you're up here, it was 80-something percent last time. We're now projecting 91% here for this. And this is the projected overall response rate based on the screener and the interview response rate.